Hello and welcome to Infinite Machine Learning. This is your host, Prateek Joshi. In each episode of this podcast, we talk to an amazing AI founder or a VC and dive deep into a specific topic. Today, we have Camilo Acosta on the show. He is a GP at Perceptive VC, a pre-seed and seed stage venture firm investing in AI-first companies across US and Latin America. He was previously a product lead at Meta. Prior to that, he was a co-founder and CEO of PayBuy Group. This is a fantastic episode. Camilo, he invests in AI companies. He has seen what products work, what products don't work. So this is a fantastic episode. All right, ready for liftoff? And 3, 2, 1, let's go. Camilo, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
You invest in AI first companies, and obviously it's a great time to be investing in AI. So at the early stages, like pre-seed and seed stages, what sets an AI startup apart in your mind? Like, what makes you go, yes, I want to invest in this company?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. And one of them I think is just relevant to any startup, and that's the founder. So that founder or founding team has to be exceptional. So it doesn't matter what the idea is, whether it's AI or not, and whether or not it's good or not, that AI, that team has to really stand out for me. And I have to really believe that this is a founding team that's going to make that vision a reality, in order for me to believe in even in that vision at all. And I think the second is a founder that sees not just the problem and opportunity space as it stands today, but how it's going to evolve over the next 10 years. AI, as everyone knows, is moving extremely fast in terms of its evolution. And the best founders understand that speed and pace of change and can skate to where the puck is going and not where it is today. And so they understand what the problem and solution will look like 5, 10 years from now, not just today.
Right. And if you look at the AI tech stack, so many opportunities for startups to make an impact, but what parts are most likely to be disrupted by startups? If you look at all the way from AI chips to infrastructure to models to applications and obviously all the sublayers, what parts are most likely to be disrupted by startups versus what's going to go to incumbents?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the incumbents, you know, the reason they are incumbents and will remain so is their proprietary data moat. They have access to so much data that no one else has, and they're able to use that to build fantastic models. You know, we can, for example, say Google has access to YouTube, you know, billions of hours of video to train AI, and not just software AI that we're kind of thinking about in terms of LLMs, but also like robotics, embodied AI, just given all the computer vision data behind a lot of these YouTube videos. So the incumbents have certain advantages for sure. But I think there's spaces, targeted application layer spaces that those incumbents will never want to participate or play in because it might be like a $10 billion company. And frankly, the Googles and Facebooks of the world are not interested in building a $10 billion business. It's just too small. So those are interesting. And then the other is infrastructure. There's no one necessarily focused on certain layers of the infrastructure that a lot of startups can play in and play a huge role in the evolution of that layer as it pertains to AI as a whole, that entire ecosystem. So I would say that it frankly is kind of runs the gamut. And then there's just some areas that are harder. Of course, I want to see more people enter the chip space and be competitive there. It's just CapEx intensive. Not to say it won't happen. NVIDIA had to start somewhere. TSMC started somewhere. And so, you know, hopefully we have more of those coming online, but it's just a lot harder.
Right. And the good thing is that companies like Grok, GROQ, they're showing that, you know, very small teams can actually build something and ship it in production and make people use it. Obviously, you need an insanely good founder, industrious, somebody who knows how to do this, but you're absolutely right. Maybe a follow-up question to that is, let's say a startup wants to tackle the hardware problem, meaning going to build AI chips for something. Maybe we'll verticalize it, we'll customize it something. Like, what does it look like at the seed stage? Because no matter how you look at it, it's impractical, it's capital intensive, and yet one of those companies is going to become a $100 billion company. So how do you assess one of those very ambitious opportunities?
those are kind of the spaces that we try to avoid, because as a smaller fund, an earlier stage fund, it's really hard to say who those breakout winners are going to be. There's a lot of great, talented teams working on these problems. And it's hard to parse through, you know, who's going to win necessarily, for a couple reasons. And generally, in some of those kinds of companies, the winners are really just the best funded ones. They end up with the most runway, which gives them the most most opportunities, basically shots on goal, to iterate and test and learn. And so sometimes they just become self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of like, oh, you raised $100 million round led by Founders Fund and Sequoia. You're probably going to win because you have the talent that's needed to just figure out if the path that's going to work. And so we don't like to play in those spaces, and those kind of rounds end up having, you know, astronomical valuations. And you see this with the foundational research companies as well. Mistral coming out with $100 million seed round at $1 billion valuation with a team of like six people. And they're accomplishing a lot, right? They're pushing out really great models. But you know, it's a tough space to play in as an investor.
Right. We talked about the AI tech stack. Now, if you look at this from a different lens, from the lens of verticalized applications, meaning there's so much AI being brought into healthcare and biology and legal, all the other spaces, what trends are interesting to you purely from this application is going to make a lot of money, a lot of revenue, because sheerly because of customer interest?
Mm-hmm. I think, frankly, all of it's interesting on the vertical side. I think every space is going to get disrupted by AI. You know, Marc Andreessen famously said that software is eating the world, and now AI is eating all software. So there really is no space that is, you know, sacrosanct and safe from the disruption of AI. Which is really cool. I think what excites me the most are the spaces where there's going to be fundamental impacts to human life. And I think a couple of those spaces are like healthcare. There's amazing things happening in computer vision. They don't get the kind of press that they really should, where we are able to now not just detect like illness and disease and cancers and whatnot, we're able to predict. There's now models that can predict with something like 96% accuracy whether a patient is going to develop lung cancer, not even if they have it, but if they're going to develop lung cancer in the next 12 months. I mean, that's life-changing. That's a huge impact on the human species if we're able to now predict evolution or development of someone getting cancer before they even have it. That's incredible. And I think we're going to see more and more of that in healthcare. Education, which is a space that has been very tough to invest in from a venture capital perspective, I think potentially has the ability to get interesting with AI. We have now seen studies that show that humans that learn from AI become better skilled at whatever that thing is than humans that learn from other humans. So now imagine if you're able to personalize and have an AI teacher for every student, you have basically the world-class teaching abilities directed at students that may have never had access to that kind of education. That's going to up-level humanity. I don't know what that looks like from an investment perspective, but that's an insane, like an immense impact that AI is going to have on the world. And so I'm very excited about those kinds of things. So vertical AI across every space is exciting, and some of them are just really going to be world-changing for humanity, not just like, great, now I have a lawyer that is AI and it works faster.
Right. It's actually amazing how much AI is being used. And not just that, it's actually like deployed in production and it's working. As you said, it's able to predict with as you said, are you going to have lung cancer in 12 months? That's huge. That's life-changing for so many people. So yeah, I'm really excited about that as well. Now, let's talk about the topic of moats for AI startup. It comes up a lot and some founders get really annoyed about it. Obviously, as a business, they have to think about it because you're a business, you're open to attack. So how do you think about moats in the sense that does it even matter at the seed stage? And if it does, what does a moat look like? And also, like, what gives a specific startup, an AI startup, an edge, or how can they build an edge over time?
I think fundamentally, at the end of the day, any startup's edge is speed. speed and rate of learning is really your competitive advantage as a small, scrappy startup. And you can look at OpenAI and Google just to see this advantage. Google has all the information basically in the world at its fingertips internally, right? Yet it was OpenAI that had this head start, you know, quote unquote, on them. And they figured out ways to scrape the internet and build models that have really, really made Google look not great, right? Like Gemini's rollout has been a PR nightmare. Does anyone think that it's the leader in GPTs? No. It's this scrappy startup OpenAI, right? And despite the fact that Google had all the advantages of the world in terms of data. And again, it's about speed. Like, how quickly can you move and learn and iterate as a company? I think eventually data becomes a commodity. Everyone will have access to it. And people are finding ways around it. Like, I see these healthcare startups where it's really hard to get your hands on healthcare data in the US because of HIPAA regulations, right? So if you're a startup in that space in AI, you want to train models. Tough, but so I've seen scrappy startups. What they do is they'll go to foreign countries. They'll go to Eastern Europe and get tons and tons of data on patients because it's less regulated over there. And then they train their models on that data. But their market is here in the US. And so there's scrappy ways to get around some of these data moats that you could say that incumbents have, or they're just tough to overcome. And that gives you an edge, right? So now those companies here in the US that have done that have an edge over the companies in the US that haven't done that or haven't figured out that out. But ultimately, that's just about speed and learning.
You mentioned earlier how computer vision doesn't get nearly as much press as it deserves because it's doing so much good, but yet it is relatively overlooked compared to, like, everyone talks about LLMs. So similarly, what other, like, overlooked opportunities exist here? Like, what do you think deserves more attention?
I'll double down on computer vision, actually, because, like, what we talked about computer vision in healthcare in terms of, like, imaging, which is amazing. It's incredible progress there. But it's not autonomy. So the end goal of artificial intelligence is really replicating and replacing human decision-making. And human decision-making has three components. There's the prediction part, the judgment part, and the action part. So prediction is like what, for example, we've talked about these AI imaging companies are able to do, where they predict this cancer is going to occur. The judgment is like, well, what are we going to do about it? Like, what should take place? Like, do we believe this? And then what should we do? What is our course of action? Then the action is actually implementing it, right? Actually seeing that plan through and executing on it. So that's actually still, it's exciting AI, but it's actually not full autonomy. So where are we in terms of full autonomy in AI? One of the most obvious spaces is actually computer vision. And when it comes to, like, self-driving cars, for example, self-driving cars actually predict, they judge, they reason, they think, or like, this is what I should or should not do, turn here, stop, move forward, et cetera. And actually do it, right? There's a full action there. So that space has full autonomy, which is incredible. So what are the applications for that? Not just on the road, but you have applications for that in defense, in agriculture, in space. So there's a lot of cool things there that, again, aren't getting talked about because maybe they're less sexy. It's less sexy to say, like, wow, we could fully automate, you know, farm labor or whatever it may be. But computer vision has come along quite far. I would argue it's probably the furthest along in terms of, again, replacing human decision-making.
As a VC, you have access to a good amount of data on, you know, what different startups are doing, you know, what's working, what's maybe not working. So for investments that have worked out well or are working out well for you right now, like, what are the common traits? Like, what are they doing right?
It's all about that founder. The common trait is less about the company and the founder and how they think, how they operate. Is this a visionary, truth-seeking individual that has a lot of raw horsepower and is targeting an area with a lot of market opportunity? If, you know, those boxes check yes, that's great. There's also an element of paranoia that I've noticed in top founders, paranoid about not just the competition, which is kind of the obvious thing, but what are the holes in their business? What are the risks that they need to de-risk quickly? And how are they going to do that? Do they obsess over that? Sometimes I run into founders that might be really smart and check a lot of boxes and whatnot, but they're a little too optimistic. Like I ask them about, you know, go to market. They're like, it's fine. It's like, you know, we're getting a lot of inbound. We have a wait list. It's great. And I'm like, is that really going to be okay? And so they're just a little delusional about how things are going to, you know, occur. It's always going to be harder than you think. And they don't seem to realize that. And that's always a red flag. but yeah, so those best companies are just led by these incredible founders that seem to have a lot of common traits. And those common traits really push the company forward into, again, testing a lot, testing quickly, learning as fast as possible.
I think you make a phenomenal point here is the best founders, they're truth seeking and they're paranoid. I think it makes a ton of sense because you're right. Many founders, even I meet many founders where they're like, oh, they loved the demo. They said amazing things, like problem solved. Like, are you really seeking the truth? Like, what does that mean? Did you ask them? Did you ask for the order? What does that, like, it's just like they're too afraid of what they'll find out. What if they ask the question and the customer says, oh, you want my money? No, thank you. Goodbye. Like that, they don't want to hear that. So I think truth seeking is such an important trait. And paranoia, which is like, okay, why haven't they signed it? It's been 2 days, 48 hours, 72 hours. Like, so I've seen many founders, oh, I sent the DocuSign like 2 weeks ago. It's going to be fine. Like it's been 2 weeks. The level of paranoia, I think you make a very good point here. I think those are very interesting characteristics. Okay. Conversely, for investments that didn't work out, obviously we can take this framework and flip it. Like people who are not truth-seeking, they're not paranoid, they don't work out. But are there any other common traits that you've noticed that, hey, other things can vary, but like these are like the common things that tell me that it's not going to work out?
This is an unfortunate one, but I do think that the best founders are the ones that need your help the least. Yes, like every founder, even some of the best have gone through periods where they'll pick up the phone and call me once a week for a span of 2 months. But the ones that have kind of consistently never succeeded are the ones that need my help constantly for things that eventually start making me worried, where I'm like, you should have figured this out. I'm not going to say that, but it kind of concerns me. I'm like, oh man, if you're having these questions, what's the rest of the business look like? and they're great because they're coachable. They want the feedback. They want to learn. But it makes me nervous that maybe they don't have the raw horsepower, or they're not learning fast enough, or they don't have the self-reliance, whatever it may be. But I see that and it scares me a bit. And you see that with first-time founders on.
Yeah. And I heard this the other day, like a similar situation where I'm glad they're coachable, but why do they need so much coaching? Like it's very,
yes.
It's like a Goldilocks zone. You know, you don't want them to be completely closed off. If they're not coachable, it's right. Not great. But if they're a little too open to coaching, that's also not great. So it's like there's a sweet spot.
Yes. Here. That's so true. Otherwise, I feel like, am I running the business basically through this puppet? Like, right. Come on. Like, you gotta have something there too.
Yeah. On your own.
But yes, it's a Goldilocks zone.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about consumer businesses. Like if you look back like 10, 12 years, everyone loved consumer. It was really hot. Everyone's chasing it. And in the last decade or so, it has flipped. Like enterprise has become the thing, and consumer, I think it doesn't get that much love, at least as it used to. So what do you think about consumer AI startups? Is there a path? If so, what does that look like? Is it prosumer? Is it another social network? Like what does that look like today?
Great questions, because I get frustrated sometimes when I see so many venture firms and they're like, we do B2B SaaS. I'm like, wow, that's so boring. Is that really going to change the world? And yeah, of course, like Microsoft is like B2B, but it's really B2B to C. So it's a consumer company at the end of the day in many ways. I think actually it's a great time to invest in consumer because a lot of venture has taken its eyes off that ball. So might as well go run after it. There's probably more alpha there right now. And I do think that there's a lot of exciting spaces for AI to take hold. you know, I saw a company recently. I can't talk too much about it because they're in stealth, but you know, they're working at the intersection of AI and social networking, and they're doing something really cool, really exciting. And it's the first. This will be the first sort of AI native social network, and it has a chance of taking off because they found a really cool nugget of insight about Gen Z and how they intersect with AI, and we'll see what happens there. So I think that there's actually a lot of really cool things that are going to come out for consumers with AI, especially because AI is capable of automating so many facets of our daily lives for consumers. It's going to be fun. It's not just like let's automate workflows for legal assistance. You know, there's way more impactful things on the consumer side.
Right. And it's funny how individuals, like a year or two ago, RAG was not a thing, but I see many like professionals, RAG has become just part of their workflow. Now. I rarely meet someone who doesn't use RAG in some shape or form. They always use like, oh, I'm using it to summarize, or I'm using it to generate like a cleaned up version. Or it's always like, it's actually nice to see that becoming part of like the regular individual's workflow. Okay, speaking of consumer, obviously, software is one way to go. What do you think about personalized computer, like just hardware devices? Obviously, Humane is one example. That execution is a TBD. But what do you think about these personalized compute devices for individuals?
I think what they're getting at is that we're going to live in this agentic future, which I agree. And it's going to be unclear what that hardware platform is, if it's something that already exists or from an incumbent. For example, the glasses, like the Facebook, the Meta glasses, Stories is what they're called. That's really moving towards a mixed reality future where you have essentially an AI assistant that lives on your glasses. And eventually, I think I can't remember which company patented it. I don't know if it was Apple or Amazon or Facebook, but one of them has already patented contact lenses. So you'll have this mixed reality that's AI really in your contact lenses. Now, what does that mean? Like, do we need another device like Humane or Rabbit, or will it just be built into those hardware platforms already? But all to say, I think it is going to change how we interact with devices. We're going to use a lot more natural language interfaces. Right now, we're using computers that are based on graphical user interfaces. This is GUI that's existed for 30 plus years. It's old school. It's old technology, and this is going to change. So now I think what they are getting at that is correct is there's going to be much more of an NLI, natural language interface, as being the more dominant, or at least a significant chunk of human-computer interaction. So I think there's something there in terms of that's where the future is going. It's unclear what that platform, hardware platform, will look like per se.
If you look at all the work, like within the world of VC, the different pieces of work, where can AI be effectively infused into these workflows?
I wouldn't be surprised if my cohort and generation of investors is actually one of the last human ones. I see a world where founders can upload a behavioral assessment, some sort of, you know, intelligence test, some sort of personality test, and a CV, and a machine learning algorithm basically spits out A, whether or not you should get funding and how much, because it understands your likelihood of success based on all of those characteristics, and maybe including your team or something and your idea perhaps. But sometimes idea doesn't matter because teams, you can fund a team that iterates and finds its way to success. You know, Twitter being an interesting example of that, Instagram, there's tons of examples of companies that pivoted into success. So I think that there is a world where this becomes automated, and the financing of startups becomes automated, and it'll become as easy as applying for a bank loan, easier than that, but based on completely different criteria than what you would apply for a bank loan today. So I think this industry will change. I don't know how long it will take. I do think that, you know, my cohort might be some of the last few humans to do it.
Right. And maybe quick part B to the question. You know, the world of venture and private equity, the information asymmetry exists a lot. I mean, it's not like public markets where you cannot act upon information that's privileged, right? So in this case, if what you're saying comes to bear, then the information asymmetry will decrease, meaning like more people will have access to the same information. So do you think that'll make the market more efficient? And also, will the participants now who benefit from this, meaning let's say big VCs who have information advantage, do you think they will oppose a structure that you're proposing? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think as humans, we always resist change that replaces our jobs, right? The jobs over centuries have evolved and been made irrelevant and basically obsolete. And so anyone in those roles always will resist it. The venture industry is still a cottage industry. It always has been. They can resist it all they want, you know, but we will be replaced. you know, it's inevitable pace of change with technology. You just can't stop it.
I think that's it's always fun. I think humans are great at adapting, and those who don't adapt, they perish. It's just part of that's how it's always been. All right. So looking at all the technological breakthroughs happening in AI right now, what are you most excited by, in the sense that, like, what's going to lead to the most seed fundable opportunities?
I think one of the biggest milestones that we need to hit for the application layer to become extremely exciting is a new operating system that is AI native. Again, that leans more into natural language interfaces and that sort of thing. I think that's where the application layer becomes really, really cool and interesting. Not many startups, I think, realize that that's where the puck is going. And so not many of them are building with that kind of future in mind. But I think when that happens, I think it's going to upend everything. It's a platform shift unlike any we've seen in a long time. And so I'm excited for the development of that to occur. And there's already companies working on that. There's startups working on that. So that future is coming.
Yeah, and Andre Karpathy had a nice presentation about LLM OS concept, and yeah, I agree. I think it's just a matter of time, because I do think a lot of the things we are doing, we feel like we're stitching it together based on existing constructs, and I think there's a big room for AI native constructs to make these things faster, better, cheaper. So yeah, I think that's going to be a great breakthrough.
Yes, I think to your point, by the way, you just made me think of an interesting analogy of using old constructs to basically stitching them together. It's like we're feeding, like, it's like a horse and buggy era, and we're feeding like the horses like better food to make them faster. It's like, whoa, we're not even close to the impact that we should be having. We're going to have cars, and that's the next thing. Yeah,
right. That's amazing. Yeah, we're in the faster horses, like horses to car transition is happening. So it's fun. All right, one last question before we go to the rapid fire round, and it's about the founders, like the AI startup founders. Obviously, they're tackling all these problems in different shapes and forms. What's like the one piece of advice you find yourself giving to like startup founders who are in your portfolio right now?
In my portfolio. Interesting question. I don't think there's something in common that I give to all of them. I have to think through that. I always have them think, it's such a fast moving space that I do always push them to think like, what does the future look like and who else could be building towards that future? It's more like the advice I give founders that are not my portfolio is more, a little more common. I see, for example, tons of co-pilots. I see tons of founders spending a lot of time on co-pilots. And I'm like, is that really the future? Do you really think that this is what the workflow is going to look like and the technology needs are going to be in 5 years? Like, ask yourself that very deeply.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a great point. I think there's too many co-pilots being built, and also for verticals that they've never, ever seen or even touched before. That's the other thing. Like, I see many people, oh, I'm gonna build a co-pilot for doctors, but in my entire life I would never once worked in healthcare or talked to doctors, but yes, I'm gonna build a co-pilot for doctors. I mean, it's like, and also we can talk about it all day, but I agree. I think you should really think strongly about what you're building, and forget 5 years, in like 12 months, will OpenAI kill you with like a small feature release?
Yes.
That's the other big
exactly.
thing. Perfect.
Yes.
All right. With that, we're at the rapid fire round. I'll ask a series of questions and would love to hear your answers in 15 seconds or less. You ready?
Okay. All right.
All right. Question number one. What's your favorite book?
The Power Law. That's my favorite book of the last few years, which is, you could probably see behind me.
Yeah. Amazing. Next question. What has been an important but overlooked AI trend in the last 12 months?
I'll go back to computer vision. I think visual language models are going to be key to the future in a way that most people are just not paying attention to.
What's the one thing about AI investing that most people don't get?
I think you have to have an understanding or at least a strong point of view of what the future is going to look like in 5 years and 10 years in order to, I think, do a good job of investing in this space, which is different from others.
What separates great AI products from the merely good ones?
I think the great ones don't think that the AI is the end all and be all. It's just, how do you make that product and experience 10 times better for the user, not the fact that it has AI in it.
Yeah.
That's not what makes it better.
I think that's a really good point. Like, the best ones, you don't even know AI is like in it. It just works. So that's magic. All right. Next question. What have you changed your mind on recently?
Oh, that's a good one. I have started to think that I used to think that you could build a global AI business anywhere. In living here in San Francisco and having now proved or like starting to prove this hypothesis with some actual real world examples, I think you have to be here to do it. You might be able to start anywhere, but you really have to be here to actually execute and build and be part of the future of AI.
Yeah. I think the density of talent and capital, which is what I think AI startups need. I think it's insane here. So I think that I agree with.
And the foresight.
And yes. Yeah. All right, next question. What's your wildest AI prediction for the next 12 months?
For the next 12 months? I have some wild predictions that people like freak out about for the next 10 years, but 12 months. It's moving so fast. I would love to see augmented reality and mixed reality become more of an understood thing. I think a lot of people thought it was a toy. And I think we're going to start to see people understand like how it's actually going to impact our daily lives in an amazingly positive way.
Right. Final question. What's your number one advice to founders starting out today?
My number one advice is find a space where you have an advantage, whether it's something about you that makes you have an advantage, something about your past, maybe about your experience. But don't build in a space where there's an N of 1,000 that look just like you. Like, find a space where you are truly differentiated.
Amazing. Camilo, this has been a brilliant episode. Loved your takes on so many things. So thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing your insights.
Thanks for having me.
What a fantastic discussion on AI startups, and specifically how to invest in AI startups. Thanks to Camilo for coming onto the show. You can visit infinitemachinelearning.com to listen to all the other episodes. Thanks again for tuning in. I'll see you soon.